I think we can avoid it getting worse if we implement all these oversight bodies, if we reduce the extent to which AI is applied to public services, if we change procurement, if we take into account our environmental policies and think of them in tandem with technological policies, if we involve people a lot more in different scales and levels that we were discussing, and if we make space for social connection, because I think that's key. I think seeing each other as part of a collective, as a fellow human, is key to reducing mistrust and to reducing misinformation and the power that manipulation can have.
Welcome to Politics, a show where two software developers break the fourth wall and talk about the interlacing of technology and politics. I'm Josh.
And I'm Ray. We see technologies like crypto, AI, and surveillance infecting our politics. Meanwhile, governments and the media are making out that all this is inevitable. We can't leave the future in the hands of scheming technology leaders and their pet politicians.
We're here to raise our voice and open up the space for honest, good faith discussions. To help us organize and sharpen our ideas, we've invited some interesting and highly respected thinkers to share their understanding and their research with us and, of course, with you.
Politics is where we smash the myths and get to the truth.
Ray, we need to talk about democracy.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems with democracy these days. It's under threat everywhere. So it would be very nice if we could have an expert on the subject come and help us to deal with the problems that we're facing. So do we know such a person, Josh?
In fact, we do, Ray. In fact, we do. And I am really happy that Anna Colum could join us today to talk about democracy. Anna, welcome back. Wonderful to have you again on the show.
Great to be here again. Thank you.
Yeah. So you are, in fact, to blame for this podcast in a way, because it was after Ray and I heard you talk last year, I think, at the Heart of Closure conference that we realized that, okay, we really need to focus on AI in our first season of Politics. So it was a very auspicious meeting. Thank you so much for that talk. So with all of that said, would you like to introduce yourself and tell folks what you do?
Great. No, and thanks again. I'm glad that talk kind of resonated. So I am a political scientist. I currently work at a research institute, a nonprofit called the Data Tank. We work on data governance, AI governance, and especially, and that's where I come in as well, on how to involve people and different publics in decisions on how these policies are designed and implemented and how technology is developed. So that's, yeah, a bit in a nutshell who I am.
When we talk about democracy, so Ray, you mentioned it's under threat everywhere, but we have democracy everywhere, right? Like we all live in countries where there are elections periodically and we get to choose representatives. So is that the kind of democracy that you're talking about, Anna, or how do you define democracy in this context?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a big question, isn't it? And we could get really philosophical about that. If we go to the word itself and its origins, it means, you know, demos kratos, power of the people. So we can think about, you know, what power people have, how is power distributed in our societies, our countries. So I think I really like to come at it in terms of power. But of course, it has many nuanced differences depending on the culture and the language and the word. So there's not only one way, obviously, of looking at it and defining it. But I think power is a key word in it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's overall how we redistribute power in society, how we decentralize it so that there can be a broad, meaningful participation of all of us. And there's even, you know, important areas of work looking at it in terms of non-human participation and how are decisions made so that non-humans, like, you know, our environment is represented in the decisions that we make.
Right.
So it can get really broad. I mean, and then we can get a bit more specific about it involving, you know, what mechanisms for transparency and accountability exist and redress. So if things go wrong or some publics don't feel protected or represented, are there mechanisms to challenge certain decisions? Then how do we make it happen? How do we operationalize democracy? So we've always said that representative democracy. So that means, you know, we vote our representatives and then they represent us. It's always been saying it's the least worst type of democracy. But I think we can see these days that it's not resilient enough. I mean, the far right is rising everywhere pretty much. So how else do we improve it? What other types of democracy do we need to really put into the mix? So we can talk more about that. And, you know, what are the information and knowledge ecosystems that also play a role in, you know, what information do we have? Who do we trust? How do we share it? How many spaces we have for collective relationships? And, you know, rather than operating in society as individuals, how are we connected to each other? I think that plays a key role as well in democracy. So, yeah, we can get very deep, but maybe I'll stop here. Yeah, and reiterate the point of power.
So just to follow up on that then, Anna, if it's the place where power sits or place where power resides, given that power exists in many places, you know, for instance, power exists in churches, it exists in workplaces, it exists in all kinds of like collective spaces. Mm. But obviously we think of democracy existing, you know, at the government level, be it like a national government, international governments, you know, local governments. So broadly, where are you focusing in terms of democracy? What kind of places do you feel are like most urgent or most urgent for this discussion?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, there's a book I was reading recently called The Sciences of the Democracies by UCL Press, and it's open access. And it makes this point that if our workplaces, or as you said, churches or other social spaces are not really democratic, and maybe they are, some are not, at different levels, but then how can we say that we live in democratic societies? So that's a very important point. But it is true that personally, in terms of my work, I focus more on different scales of governments. So from the local to the national / state to the regional government, which is where policies that affect the delivery of public services are designed and discussed and then executed. So that's where I come in. But there's people that specialize in, for example, democracy in the workplace. And I think these are very important as well. And in terms of what shape it takes, we're probably quite behind.
Okay, so if that's where you're focusing, so like then what, how do you define democracy in terms of like the gold standard for democracy versus the silver, the bronze, and the wooden spoon? You know, how are you kind of evaluating the quality of the democracies that we're living in? Because I know obviously that it varies, and I know there are studies and rankings around the world of various democracies. So is that an interesting like landscape at least to set our conversation in?
I think it is. I think there's been specific components of democracies that have been thought to be helpful benchmarks to kind of evaluate. I mean, these rankings are always flawed, of course, in a way, because, you know, sometimes if you forget one component, then you think a country is democratic, but then it might not for someone living in that country because of, you know, other components that maybe have not been looked at. But yeah, I think it's about, yeah, the classic division of powers, you know, so there has to be governments that design and execute policies, but the decision about whether these policies are legitimate that comes from processes of discussion, deliberation by people who have been elected in fair, theoretically fair elections where most of the people can take part. I say most because we know not everyone can take part in elections, and there's debates about the minimum ages, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, at least a big majority. And then, as I said, for me, it's also important, yeah, the independence of the judiciary, the legal aspect, and then a thriving civil society, whether that constituency has spaces to enable and protect mobilization, activism, participation, associations. So yeah, it's not only the top-down. I don't think it's definitely not enough to have kind of a top-down approach to democracy, but there has to be space for a vibrant civil society where people feel they can have a say, they can mobilize, they can demonstrate, they can protest, you know, it's all of those elements.
I think most people think of democracy as I go to the polls, I vote for the local government, the regional government, the national government. And that's the kind of, at least in terms of participatory democracy, that's the most common form of democracy, electoral democracy that we have these days. So I would like to have a conversation about more than that.
Yeah.
Obviously, we can devolve away from that and we can evolve further than that. But let's just take that part for the moment. Where do you feel like we have threats right now? We can talk about AI in a minute as well, because that's going to come into it. But like you said, there's far-right people coming at things. That was happening prior to AI. And but there may be other aspects that AI is worsening. So before we get into the whole like technology stuff, can we just like take a reading, like a room reading, if you like, about what the most common definition of democracy, this electoral democracy, where are you kind of like putting your finger in the air and like taking a reading on that side of things?
Yeah, I think it's not enough. Yeah, I think we're seeing it's not working well enough to just rely on it. I think we still need to be able to, of course, have elections and representatives, but not to rely only on them. I've done quite a bit of work and research on deliberative democracy. Deliberative democracy means that you are involving publics, and there's a specific type that's called representative deliberative democracy, where you use sortition to randomly select people that's representative of the differences in society so that they can also be another component alongside the legislative, executive, etc., to make or monitor or oversee decisions. Well, we can talk a bit about this a bit more, but I guess the point is that the current system of electoral representative democracy is not enough, and it's failing for a few reasons. One of them is because the incentives are not constructive enough, especially to address the challenges that we're facing today. So what's happening is that the people we elect, they should be proposing policies and delivering policies that can help us solve the challenges we are living in, like lack of investment in public health services or the urgency of the climate change and climate emergency and important policies that need to be taken. But these are difficult policies that sometimes people are against because there's not enough information or understanding, or there's mistrust about why do we need now to, you know, why cannot now take my car into the town center, for example. You know, to me, it's shocking that people are against policies that, you know, are going to improve air pollution, are going to enable that we have more trees, help us into a better future. But there's still a lot of backlash. So politicians don't dare, and also have a lot of pressure from, you know, like fossil fuel companies, etc., to deliver these policies. So we are in this kind of cycle where not really delivering policies that we need, but also we are increasing mistrust between us and between society. And then there's the information aspect that comes into play as well.
So before we go any further, I mean, so there's democracy. So if we vote for a government, but you're saying they're not delivering, we just get a new government, and then they will deliver. So what? Why isn't that working? I mean, you know, if we just can vote them out and then we get the new one in, then they make the good policies. No, I know it's kind of like amusing, but that's where we are now. That's what people still believe, this concept, you know, that they can vote for a politician. And if the politicians, I mean, I've got some ideas, and I'm sure that Josh does, about like what the constraints are on the politicians today. And I think that's central to what's going on. The question is it a problem with the actual politicians, or is it a problem with the way that those politicians are permitted to act? In other words, is there a hidden set of forces behind this so-called democracy where, oh yeah, okay, we vote for the government. They've said they're going to do X, Y, and Z to make our lives more affordable, to make the planet better, because everyone is going to promise us good things. and then they don't deliver it. So we get the next one in, and then they don't deliver it, and we get the next one in. You know, why don't they deliver it? That's the problem to me, is if democracy is working, if democracy is practical, why isn't it working? Why can't people deliver what they say?
I think there's definitely forces at play. I mean, I think governments who have tried to implement more progressive policies or fulfill their program, they've been faced with a lot of lobbying, pressure, misinformation campaigns, etc. Then there's private interests, corruption still at play, you know, like there's a lot of lobbying from powerful companies that also plays a role. And then I think there's lack of information and lack of spaces to really understand collectively what vision of a society do we want. Mm-hmm. We can see in governments where parties that were considered to be more on the left side, they are now moving into the center or even into the right in terms of some policies, like, for example, migration policies. And, you know, I find it extremely disappointing, but I think, why are they not standing their ground and offering a vision for what a policy that's not the policy of the far right could be? I think sometimes society doesn't have anyone that's giving them a vision and that's saying that's actually possible, and that's backed up by, let's say, evidence, as well as, you know, it has the buy-in from all these sectors in society. There's a lack of alternative, meaningful alternatives, and of conviction that these alternatives can be implemented. So I think what's happening is that some people who are already towards the center or the right are saying, actually, I'd rather get the proper right, you know, since like there's no alternative that's convincing to people that are already not convinced. I think at least that, for example, what I can see in the UK and in other countries in Europe, mm-hmm. I can see people governments who you would think are from the left replicating and repeating discourses that are typical of the far right. And that's, really disappointing, but that's what I can see happening.
Yeah, it being in the UK, the Labour government, certainly the current one, I would say, is certainly speaking or playing right out of the kind of right-wing playbook. I mean, it's not really been any different from the conservative policies, you know, and it was the same in the US with the last election. You know, a lot of the Democratic candidates were trying to kind of be tough on immigration and all of this. So yeah, that is very frustrating. And I think the lack of alternatives is something that's really important. Like, politicians are not kind of talking about the society that they want to build. It feels more like just not this thing we have right now. What we have now is bad. But you talked a little about, you know, the constraints on the politicians. And one of the things you pointed to was the corporate lobby. We have some really, well, increasingly huge and powerful companies. And this is very kind of apropos to this podcast. A lot of those big and powerful companies are actually tech companies these days. So you mentioned the fossil fuel companies, but there's also, you know, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Facebook. I refuse to call them Meta. So I'm just wondering, do you want to dive more into what the corporate lobby does to kind of distort our hopes for democracy, maybe?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I knew we were going to talk about technology. So I mentioned the fossil fuel companies, and it's clear. I mean, there's this image from the elections in the United States where you could see all the CEOs of these big tech companies you've mentioned on stage next to Trump. And that's already so illustrative of what's happening. So yeah, there's clearly a concentration of power in the tech industry itself, which now is working hand in hand. Well, it's not now. It's of course, this is something that's been building up for a long time, but it's now very explicit, working hand in hand with political power. And yeah, it's extremely concentrated. It's going into what many people have described as techno-authoritarianism. We can see the role that these big tech companies are playing in the really unacceptable policies that are taking place, and the IC kind of raids and expulsion and persecution of different communities in the States. And so, yeah, you can't really separate these big tech companies from the current lack of democracy that we can see. And there's this great book by Marichi Schaak. She was a former MEP, called The Tech Coup. And I really recommend the book because it really goes through, you know, how this has been building up and how we have reached that point. The book came out before that image, so before it was even talked about as a tech coup. So she really provides a very interesting analysis. But yeah, I mean, we can see the dependencies as well. I mean, these companies now control most of the state infrastructure. And we can see that the Department of Defense of the States has so many contracts, subcontracts with these companies. So they, as Shaki herself describes, they've become, these tech companies have become like state agents. So yeah, that's a really concerning turn. And also we can see in Europe this dependency with this infrastructure. That's why we have a lot of talk now in Europe about digital sovereignty and what it means, etc. So yeah, we've reached a point where we can see how democracy is directly threatened by this concentration of power, I think.
Yeah. So one of the things that you mentioned before is also about scale of democracies. So if we talk about the three of us making a democratic decision about where to go for dinner, right, that's pretty easy to do. It might take us 5 minutes if we each have strong preferences that are not quite aligned, but we'll figure it out in 5 minutes. You know, and then if you have that same discussion with your entire company, you know, 100 or 200 people, that gets harder, and it gets increasingly harder as you scale up. And so I think, you know, one way that we've tried to address that problem is the idea of representative democracy, where it's like, okay, I trust you, Anna, to make a decision that's, you know, more or less good for me. So I'm going to vote for you and give you that power. But what other ways are there to exert democratic control over these important decisions that are being made other than just voting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's where I think that we need to combine different mechanisms or types of democracy. I think I mentioned earlier deliberative democracy, and I think it has a lot of potential. Deliberative democracy is about really deliberating an issue, but with a baseline of understanding, a baseline of knowledge. So it's about getting together, specifically if we talk about representative deliberative democracy. So it's about finding a specific limited number of people that represents the different groups in society. We can do it by demographics as well as other types of ways of ensuring that it's an inclusive group. But what happens is that this group, it's not really about voting. Sometimes there's a vote at the end, and sometimes it's followed by a referendum where everyone can vote, like Ireland has done many times. But what happens in this group is that they really take the time to understand an issue and deliberate and try and see where the different views are and where there can be common ground, and then make recommendations to a government, for example. These deliberative groups can also have an oversight role, so maybe not making policy recommendations, but actually overseeing, like a popular jury in some countries it's called, but applied not to courts, but to government decisions. So I think that deliberation is important because we are losing the capacity to understand the different viewpoints in society and sometimes realize that maybe they are not so polarized as we think they are, because often in the media, and especially with the current social media, is designed to grab attention and engagement through really showing like very, you know, extreme views. And we think that we are very polarized, but then when you have these processes of deliberation, you can see that actually, yeah, you have a different view than me, but I can see maybe where we can agree and agree to disagree. So I think we need more of these deliberative processes. There's many happening in many countries at the local, but also at the national level. And we need to think about how we embed them. In some places, they are already embedded and made kind of a permanent institution in some cities and governments. But I think we need to make a better use of these processes. And then in some cases, referendums might be appropriate. Sometimes they are not, because again, they might be just asking for a vote on an issue that's very polarized and there's not been time to understand.
Yeah, it's really interesting what you say about polarization, because that is the narrative, right? Oh, we're so polarized, we can't agree on anything. And I think that's dangerously simple. I think, in fact, it plays into the hands of the forces wanting to kind of just run with their agenda. If they can convince the public that the other side are all idiots and they hate everything that you love and so on, then they've kind of got us bickering with each other, and then they can just kind of pursue their agenda. You mentioned social media is one thing that's kind of driving both the polarization, but also the kind of polarization narrative. And I'm just wondering, what ways do you see technology threatening democracy?
Yes, I think we can look at it from different lenses. I think one lens, which is the geopolitical, we've already kind of discussed, which is more about the concentration of power on these companies and how this is affecting how decisions are made and who makes them, etc., and what interests are behind. I think another aspect to that is the narrative around techno-solutionism, the power of hype and the power of promises of efficiency, that technology will solve everything, and just distracting really from more deeper conversations about how we should make decisions, what democratic spaces we need to enable, mechanisms to protect, etc. That's how technology is used at the moment. You know, a lot of uses for surveillance, a lot of uses in decisions around how public services are designed and delivered. But then there's also the design of the technologies. So who's designing them? What data is being used? Where are they being applied? And there's also, there's been a lot of research on how they are enabling this kind of, or seeking for these attention loops. So they are designed so that we get the content that creates more attention and more emotional reactions rather than spaces that maybe are more cognitively more difficult to engage with, but that might help us understand each other better. There's, of course, then the manipulation of electoral processes, the misinformation, the deep fakes, etc. So different technologies have, different affordances or, different possibilities for threatening democracy. Maybe they also have it for improving it. We can talk about that maybe later. But there's all these different angles we can look at.
One of the things I think about a lot is how technology kind of narrows our perspective on thinking and the expression that we're capable of. To your point, if you want to have a deliberative consultancy, having just a thumbs up and a thumbs down, those are the two choices you have. That's kind of like a Facebook or a YouTube kind of, like or dislike kind of thing. Mm-hmm. These things, we can do all kinds of sentiment analysis based on top of that, but you don't get to the point of what people actually think. Mm-hmm. All you get is a sort of a pro and a con, a yes and a no. It's very black and white. So that's one of the fundamental limitations of these kind of broad applications of technology, is that they narrow the scope of any consultation or any solution that we can come up with. But is that something that chimes with your understanding and your research?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, there's been most of this social media that is now kind of concentrating the largest number of users is not really giving much space for dialogue and deliberation. There's been other technologies that are being designed and explored, and we can talk a bit about some examples that are trying to not do that and are trying to find other ways to enable people to find common ground. There's also been research about how social media have enabled other narratives and have enabled other publics to have a voice and to build their own narratives. In the earlier days of Twitter, for example, there was quite a lot of research on that. For example, I know of research done by really great academics in Kenya, like Nanjala Nyabola, that looked at how social media, they're enabled the emergence of counterpublics, because we moved from this kind of public sphere that was dominated by just a few media, often not independent media, to a networked sphere where there were different publics that could kind of say, hey, we're here, they could build their own. So there's been, I guess, positives to it. And even, we've seen revolutions that happened in the earlier 2000s or later like the...
The Arab Spring, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly that. The Arab Spring, which was called also the Facebook revolution, the Twitter revolution. So there was a lot of hope and different views that were less negative. But we've seen that at the end of the day, yeah, these technologies are controlled by a few companies that can decide how to design them and which voices to suppress or not. And at the end of the day, it's about the whole political ecosystem. It's not only about the technology.
You mentioned techno-solutionism there. And, you know, one of the things we should acknowledge is AI is being pitched as the solution to all problems. And I'm just wondering what the discourse is around democracy. Like, what are people saying, hey, AI can fix in our democratic processes?
Yes. The main discourse is still around efficiency and scale. Mm-hmm. So a big concern now for example, public sector is, okay, we've seen that if we do deliberative mini publics, so the citizens' assemblies that we were talking about before, we can get really in-depth, engaged residents and citizens, very helpful dialogues, but we want to reach more people. With a citizens' assembly, we get 100, 60, 30, depending on the... how do we scale democracy, basically?
Right.
That's the narrative around that at the moment. But then that's a tricky problem, because with scale, can you keep this nuance? Can you keep this depth? Can you keep this ability to get people meet face-to-face or both online and face-to-face, really get to know each other and have a meaningful dialogue? Because another thing with technology is similar to road rage, you know, that sometimes when you are distanced from the person, when you don't have the person in front of you, it seems easier to be rude or dismissive or less careful, less empathetic. So
they're dehumanizing, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So it's about how can you build technologies that do not do that, that still keep this ability to see the other as a human fellow being.
Yeah.
And enable a meaningful discussion. And that's where a lot of the discourse, at least in my field, is now. I mean, and there's a discourse of trying to build social media that's independent from the big tech and that's decentralized and federated.
Right.
But then there's a discourse of different type of technologies that enable this deliberation and these meaningful encounters, but at scale.
Do you see any promising applications of technology? I mean, it doesn't have to be specifically AI, but, you know, what are the things that you see that might actually have some promise in them and are not just techno-solutionism?
What I can see so far in terms of the technologies that are being developed, they are quite mechanical solutions. So, for example, if you're having a citizens' assembly, there's people looking at how you can make the process more transparent and create outputs that connect this assembly with a larger public in cheaper and faster ways, or how you can help participants and facilitators of these processes make sense of what's being said and keep track. So it's kind of more like dealing with analysis and maybe communication. I don't think it's really tackling the issue. For me, the structural issues of, you know, how do we create meaningful spaces of encounters? How do we have checks and balances? How do we audit the algorithms that public sector is using, you know, to make important decisions? How do we change procurement so that there's proper public engagement, environmental standards, and safety checks on, you know, these algorithms? So I think there's deeper issues, I think, around our democracies that are more important, I think, than looking at scaling up these processes. But, you know, there's still space for, I mean, we can talk about the case of Taiwan. If you want, it's always mentioned as an example of a country that used technology meaningfully. There's a tool called Polis.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah.
It's like a wiki poll. So it means that you are not really voting yes or no. You are in a way, but then what the tool does, it enables everyone to vote on some sentences as well as propose some sentences. And then it shows where people are in terms of what groups agree with what arguments, where they disagree, but also where there's points of encounter. and for what reason. So then you can see in a visual way, okay, so this person thinks very different to me on that point, but actually for them it's important. Let's say Taiwan looked at, for example, the case of Uber and how to navigate different views about whether Uber taxis should be allowed or not. And there was those who were very much against, there were those who were very much in favor, but then even those who were in favor agreed that there should be regulated the sector. So then that was a kind of a point of encounter where those who disagreed and those who agreed said, okay, we all can agree that this has to be regulated. So that's an example of a case study. Basically, this tool allows you to see not where people disagree, but actually what are the point of encounter. So I think that there's scope for tools like that can enable, these technical approaches to enabling more constructive dialogues. But I'm always careful that we don't fall into techno-solutionism. If, you know, we can use and develop some of these tools if they are in a context where there's actually a government that's going to take regulation seriously, there's going to be checks and balances, etc. There's going to be transparent ways of making decisions.
And talking about like transparent decisions and stuff like this, I'm wondering if the dialogue in your community is also about dispersing power a bit more, because it feels to me like at the moment that you can definitely think about technology as a way of scaling things up, but you can also think about technology as a way of enabling more local power, or even just forgetting technology for the moment. You know, isn't it a good idea to think about, if you want power to be representative of the people, then you give them more capabilities over things that affect their lives?
Yes, exactly. And I think that's where the scale is important, because often we're still stuck in this idea of the nation state. Mm-hmm. But what happens with that, for example, in the case of Europe, is that it ends up being quite a top-down and for some peoples and regions, quite an oppressive way of making decisions, where states are very diverse and everywhere, but even in Europe, we talk about Italy, Spain, the UK, France, as if they were monoliths, but actually there's many different languages and types of people and needs in them. So I agree. I think we need to decentralize power and enable more bottom-up and more local approaches so that, it's going to enrich us all and people are going to feel more represented, or that they have more of a say, or that their needs are being heard and addressed.
I was just going to say, I mean, because I'm not a libertarian, for example, so I don't believe in like this concept of complete devolution to sort of like 50 people and then, you know, all of those people are responsible for building their own roads, making their own drugs and this kind of nonsense. You know? So I want to make it clear that, you know, I think some things need to be kind of shared at a higher level than just the municipal level. Mm-hmm. But I feel like and the challenge then is the interface, basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's like, how do you interface between like each of the levels of a particular representative democracy?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if technology is an answer to that or if it's just more about thinking about structures and having consensus, good old fashioned thinking, you know, rather than, and dialogues rather than thinking about technology.
There's something there, Ray, because technology ultimately is what it does is automate stuff, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Technology is never going to solve a problem for us that we don't know how to solve. Like, we have to figure out how to solve it ourselves. And then sure, technology can make certain things that are very difficult for us to do manually possible. But kind of to what you were saying, I think we do have to put technology completely to the side for a second and just think through like how we actually would connect democracy. One of the things that always gets me riled up is if you look at sustainable agriculture, like we know how to do it. We absolutely could do it if we just decided to. And I'm wondering, what's your view on it? Do we know how to do democracy? If you could snap your fingers and just make things go like this, like would it work?
No, I mean, I wish I had the solution. I think it's obviously a complex, super complex. But I think we can change things in terms of And it has to be a mix. It has to be a mix of approaches and mechanisms. As I said before, I think we need to complement representative electoral democracy. I think that's not enough. Mm-hmm. And using deliberative and participatory democracy, and technology can be a component, but not, we shouldn't take a techno-solutionist approach to that, of course. That would be already a helpful way. I think there's a lot of research on how deliberative spaces are quite empowering. People really feel a sense of, okay, yeah, I have a say here. I see my neighbor differently here. There's quite a lot of evidence on all of that. So I think there's potential to not necessarily scaling up these processes, but having them at the local level, but many more, and then having a mechanisms for these local processes to then fit into a more regional processes and then ultimately fit into national state processes. I think there's scope for that. And then other issues are still to do with systems that are not working very well, like legal or judiciaries in some contexts that are not independent, or lack of mechanisms for redress when things go wrong, or lack of independent, sustainable media that can do investigative journalism. In the case of AI now, a lot more oversight bodies and auditing spaces for civil society to really be able to have a say. Civil society is still seen as a bit of a nuisance in some spaces, you know, and their expertise is not yet taken seriously. You know, you can see often they're invited because just to say that we've involved civil society, but they are not really taken seriously as, let's say, the tech lobbies. Despite civil society is formed by, you know, many types of expertise, sociologists, lived experience, legal experts, all sorts. So, yeah, I think there's many things I would do that we can do. I'm not saying that this would solve anything, obviously, or everything. Hopefully something, yes. But I think there's many aspects that we need to approach. And the media ecosystem being another one of them. But maybe that's another conversation altogether.
Well, maybe, but maybe we can bring it on to it. One of the things that obviously this series is about AI, and we've touched a little bit on AI, and you mentioned it in your response there. We could take a little, a little perspective on what is happening in your community around what people are proposing that AI could do to, or what are the dangers, let's say, or the risks of the current AI manifestations that we see. Maybe we could just take a little audit of that with you, Anna, just to see what you perceive as the current sort of risks to democracy by the current instantiations that we have.
Yes, so there's a few aspects to that. One is, for example, the way it's helping to expand surveillance. None of these issues that we'll probably talk about now are new, but it's just how it's amplifying it and making it so much easier and faster. The other is how it can manipulate opinion and electoral processes, from creating fake content to targeting personalized ads or just create deep fakes, etc. I think how it's damaging social cohesion, and we talked about this when we talked about attention loops that some of these social media tools that are so present now are designed. The other thing is how it's being implemented in public services. And I talked a bit about it in the Heart of Closure talk that you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, how it's being, with a narrative of efficiency, it's being used to decide who will get social services or not, or who is suspicious or just directly, flagged as someone that's committed fraud, for example. How it can, just as we were talking about now, damage self and collective determination. If decisions are being relied on AI tools more and more, how about our own agency to deal with difficult decisions? Because some decisions should be difficult, like democracy. It involves friction. It cannot be really fast-tracked. It cannot be automated. So I think a big risk is that this narrative of efficiency and scaling up is actually not what we need at the moment.
Just to add on to that, the other thing, I think people think about AI being applied, like you say, in public services. But I noticed with some interviews of, I'm not going to call them respected politicians, but certainly eminent politicians, who openly, will use AI themselves. They will use these AI bots to ask questions and get advice. This seems completely wild to me that eminent politicians would admit that they're essentially going to the AIs for policy advice.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, yeah. And thinking that having a bot to respond to residents' requests is a great way of engaging and responding instantly to the public. That's what's concerning, that we seem to have forgotten, or maybe intentionally forgotten, what democracy is about. It's about dialogue, it's about accountability, it's about listening. And just to use an intermediary that's automated and that doesn't think to do that, it's destroying all of that.
Yeah, exactly. Because it strikes me that democracy is not just about getting the answer right. It's, you know, the value is actually the discussion, the meeting of the minds, the understanding, you know, our commonalities and so on. So if you just ask a bot, how should I set my tariffs, for example, just, you know, I'm making something up that completely didn't happen in real life. But what you get is you get a thing and you have no idea what the motivations for that are, you know, and I think like understanding people's motivations is actually a very important part of democracy that we shouldn't throw away in the name of efficiency.
Exactly, exactly. And these tools, I mean, AI is a big thing and there's many type of technologies within it, of course, but a lot of it now it's about predicting or, you know, kind of probabilistic way of operating. And yeah, we are reducing everything, or, you know, very important decisions to that, which is counteractive to what we should be doing, I think. So I don't know. I hope slowly when we go maybe out, if we go out of this kind of bubble of hype, society slowly starts realizing what these tools are about and whether we can focus our investments and our infrastructure into other types of technology, other types of AI, because at the moment, yeah, everyone seems still to be in a bit of a bubble of hype. I think that's my perception, at least, you know, hearing even friends who are using it to consult, or AI assistant specifically, to consult, yeah, things that maybe you could consult with a psychotherapist, or, you know, like we're really, really, it's quite concerning how all aspects of society are being reduced to these specific technologies.
One thing that maybe it's a sort of challenge to this as well is, myself and Josh have spoken about this many times, about efficiency and essentially our hatred for efficiency, because efficiency is sort of like, it's got a feeling of goodness. It's got a feeling of, or an aura, or a sort of freightedness of positivity. And yet often, I think in the tech world and in the world that we're living in today, efficiency is becoming some sort of like aim in itself, some sort of good in itself. And so to your point about like, oh, we want to use AI for efficiency. If you think about democracy is, and especially the things that you're talking about in terms of deliberate consultation, it's slow, It's time consuming, it's actually inefficient. I mean, you know, it's necessarily inefficient. Now, it may be that overall it's more effective. And I think this is the problem that people mix efficiency with effectiveness. And I think sometimes it's deliberate.
Yeah, I think it's part of the narrative and it's very convenient. True, in some cases it might be not intentional and really genuinely in some sectors people might think that it will help with efficiency, but I think overall it's part of this narrative of techno-solutionism and concentration of power, and it's part of the slogans like, oh, AI will help us solve our public health crisis, AI will help us spend more time with residents because we will automate everything else. But we've seen that over and over with other technologies as well, no? That it's a way to distract from the real issue, which is that, is there enough investment going into the right sectors? Are we spending too much on defense and too little on public health, for example? It's distracting from all these other aspects of how our governments are organized and how decisions are made and whether there's enough checks and balances. Yeah, I see it very much as part of the narrative.
So we've been talking for a while, and I think we should look for some bright spots in this. So I'm just wondering, you know, clearly technology, AI, we need to somehow exert democratic control over this. And I'm wondering, have you seen any examples of that being effectively done?
So, yeah, it's being tried from different angles. Again, one of them is regulation, and different states and regions, of course, the known EU AI Act in Europe, which is in itself, of course, contested, and now there's attempts to simplify it as well. But regulation is important, and it's being attempted in some cases in more innovation ways. Again, another key narrative that sometimes distracts from important aspects. In other ways, it's approached more from a social impact lens. But yeah, there's examples in addition to regulation of civil society mobilizing. There's cases where, for example, I was reading before about a case in Brazil where different coalitions of civil society organizations coordinated to lobby Meta and Google and different far-right groups that were trying to weaken platform accountability. So these organizations managed to change or diminish at least some of the changes that these corporate lobbies were seeking. So there's examples of civil society really moving and achieving things. And then there's attempts as well to change procurement in some contexts so that when public sector is buying AI technologies, that there's some regulation in how it's going to be bought, some conditions about where this technology is located, who owns it, the environmental standards, whether there's public engagement and democratic process around this. And then there's other attempts through freedom of information requests. So that's the democratic mechanisms that should be available anyways, parliamentary inquiries, petitions. There's need for more oversight bodies. But yeah, there is a lot of resistance and negotiating and implementation of democratic mechanisms that do exist in many countries, just so that, as you were saying, not to be too negative. So yeah, I think we can also look, of course, for the positive, which is all the mobilization and the work and the research and the policy that's being designed around that. There's both a lot of lobbying for simplifying regulation and for allowing more technology and AI to be implemented everywhere for public services. Lots of tech power in that way. But at the same time, there's also another front of policymakers, experts, civil society that are moving in the other direction. So it's really difficult to know which way it will go. But I think we can avoid it getting worse if we implement all these oversight bodies, if we reduce the extent to which AI is applied to public services, if we change procurement, if we take into account our environmental policies and think of them in tandem with technological policies, if we involve people a lot more in different scales and levels that we were discussing, and if we make space for social connection, because I think that's key. I think seeing each other as part of a collective, as a fellow human, is key to reducing mistrust and to reducing misinformation and the power that manipulation can have. So I think we need to continue working on all these aspects, but who knows? I think we can only be positive, because otherwise it just gets too difficult. So I remain positive, even if sometimes it's difficult when you see the headlines in the media about what's happening and what some countries are doing. But yeah, there's a lot of very important, good, positive work taking place. So it's good to focus on that as well.
Yeah. And how do you think people like us and our audience, who are probably a lot of whom are technologists, how can we get involved in the things that you're talking about?
I think now there's a lot of scope, a lot of attempts, and more investment, I think, on building decentralized, federated, collaborative ecosystems and infrastructure. So I think there is a crucial role for technology developers, etc., to help build this infrastructure and those spaces in collaboration, because none of us as sectors or disciplines can do anything alone. And more, I think we need to cross this kind of discipline or sector boundaries and collaborate. So yeah, I think there's a lot of potential for technology experts, developers, engineers, etc., to build these tools think about how they can be built in ways that are environmentally friendly, in ways that enable for less efficiency and more effectiveness, as you were saying, Ray, in what it means to build collaborative and open and decentralized interoperable infrastructure.
Okay, great.
Well, I think that is probably a pretty good place to end it then, on a positive note, a call to action. So I just want to say again, Anna, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us. I really enjoyed this conversation. Certainly a lot of interesting thoughts. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Before we go, I would just like to say thank you to Ketchup4 for transcribing this episode. If you would like to support the show by volunteering to transcribe an episode, please reach out to us by sending an email to politex@politex.dev or a message on Blue Sky or Mastodon. Okay, Ray, take it away.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Politex. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@politex.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Politex on Blue Sky and at Politex at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is politex.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!